Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Autism gets our attention. It's tough, and it could be, it is, our kids. The rule of thumb has come to be 1 in 100 or 1 in 110 kids facing autism. Now a big new study says 1 in 38. That's a shocking jump. Of course, it's all in the filter. The details may be the definition. It was done in South Korea, but its authors say it's globally applicable. The lead author is with us. This hour On Point, the prevalence of autism. You can join the conversation. Are you shocked by these numbers? 1 in 38 with an autism spectrum disorder. Do you believe the numbers? Understand them? What's going on? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New Haven, Connecticut, is Dr. Youngshin Kim, a child psychiatrist and epidemiologist. She is lead author of the big and, by all accounts, very well-respected new study on the prevalence of autism that was conducted in South Korea by Yale University's Child Study Center and George Washington University and published yesterday in the American Journal of Psychiatry. I should say the study begins with a 27-point questionnaire for parents to screen for potentially autistic kids. That questionnaire is very interesting, and it's at our website, onpointradio.org. Dr. Kim, Youngshin Kim, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Your numbers are turning a lot of heads. This was done in a town not far from Seoul, South Korea. Tell us how you did the study. How is it different from the way we measure the rates of autism, at least so far have measured them, in the United States, Dr. Kim?
Yes. So there have been much concern about the actual prevalence of ASD and why ASD prevalence has been increasing over the last four decades.
ASD, so ASD autism spectrum disorder, you're saying. We'll look
yes.
at that. Okay.
Yes. So evidence suggests that this increase may be due to the varying methods used in previous ASD prevalence research, including differences in how ASD diagnoses were made and the ages of the children when ASD diagnosis was made.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, unlike prevalence studies in of other medical conditions like obesity or asthma that included a larger community-based sample, most ASD prevalence studies targeted narrow groups of children who were much more likely to have ASD, such as those enrolled in special education or had a mental health service or enrolled in disability registries.
But in this study in South Korea, you looked at the entire population of children aged 7 to 12, as I understand it, in the city of Goyang in the Ilsan district. You looked at not just those in special ed or special classes, but every single child in that community.
That is correct. So that's the most unique feature of this study, because we wanted to estimate the most comprehensive ASD prevalence as possible. So we decided to include all the children, including those in the mainstream schools, without any known history of developmental delays or psychiatric services.
But what does it mean then that the American surveys have come back with 1 in 100 or 110, about 1%, and that up substantially from U.S. reports in earlier years. But 1%, and you're coming up with 1 in 38, that's about 2.6%. That's more than double. And your study says or suggests that these are globally applicable numbers. Does that mean that around the world, are you suggesting that 1 in 38 children globally are on the autism spectrum, have some autism spectrum disorder?
Well, so if we look at the population in our study from disability registries and special education schools and who use the mental health service, then we have the very similar prevalence estimate. In that population, we have 0.75% prevalence, which is not that different
in
from
1%. In this Korean
1%.
Community. Mm-hmm.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
So the excess of the prevalence, 2.64%, is coming from the prevalence of ASD in the children in mainstream schools, which is 1.89%.
So are you suggesting that in the United States or globally, we're missing a lot of kids with autism issues because we're only looking at those presenting the most acute or obvious symptoms?
That is our suggestion. It's not going to be exactly 2.64% because it's an estimate. But we're confident that ASD prevalence probably is in the range of 2 to 3% if we use the same method in the United States.
If you go back to the American way of measuring, where we've got about 1%, if you go back to just 2007, I'm seeing reports that the rate was just 0.6% in the U.S. Now 1%. People are going to look
That's
at your
correct.
2.6%, and we get that there's a different way of measuring here, but I think that the first question many people are going to ask is, does your study suggest that the rate of autism is increasing, that more and more kids are getting autism as a percentage of the population or have it?
So first of all, this is a prevalence study, and prevalence study cannot answer the question like that because prevalence study goes to the community and counting the children with autism spectrum disorder in the community. Whereas, is there any increase of the ASD cases? That can be answered by the instance study. The instance means that you follow the group of people who didn't have the disorder at the beginning for a period of time and then count the people who newly developed the disorders. In that case, we can answer if there is an increase of new cases of ASD or not. Our study simply suggests that there are a group of children with ASD in the mainstream schools that we forgot to count. And 2/3 of the kids with ASD were unrecognized and untreated in the community.
Well, then maybe this is about the definition to explain this bigger number. We understand you're screening more kids here. In South Korea, everybody goes to public schools. They were very cooperative. Unlike the U.S., you know, you don't have several different systems at once. So you really did get everyone. But what about your definition? You're saying that they had this 2.6%. 1 in 38 had an autism spectrum disorder.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how far out from what we recognize as severe autism does that go? Are you counting kids who just, I don't know, have trouble concentrating? What's the definition? How wide-ranging, then, is your definition, this ASD, autism spectrum disorder?
That's a very excellent question. So autism spectrum disorder has 5 different subtypes in DSM-4, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual Edition 4, that is a gold standard diagnostic criteria. And in that category, there is a classical autism that we know, and then other ones like atypical autism, which is PDD-NOS, and Asperger disorder, and then 2 other disorders, childhood disintegrative disorder and Rett disorder. So, but all those 5 disorders have a common feature, which is a lack of social reciprocity, and that's the heart of the ASD symptoms. And when we went into Korean community and did this study, we had this 2-step case identification processes mm-hmm. that began with the systematic standardized multi-implement screening, the screener that you described about, 27 items. And the second step used a diagnostic assessment that is accepted internationally
right.
as a gold standard for making ASD diagnosis. So we used the international gold standard and autism spectrum disorder that we define here in the United States or in the Europe, and that same definition was applied to the children in Korea, and we come up with the 2.64%.
But describe the, I don't know, what to a layperson might be the least affected end of that 2.6%, those with just Asperger's or maybe mild Asperger's. I mean, do all of these 2.6% have a debilitating problem with the autism spectrum, or are some of them just mildly affected, doesn't really matter? I mean, here's we have listeners responding to our conversation already, Dr. Kim, and here's one saying, oh, come on, we all have something in some amount, don't we? Is suggesting, you know, maybe your number's so high because it includes children who have a little touch of autism or autism spectrum disorder so mild that it doesn't matter.
Well, the listener has a very excellent point. And there are two schools in autism spectrum disorder research, that it's a categorical disorder, meaning that it's a qualitatively different disorder, whereas this is a quantitative matter. It's a continuous measure that we have, continuous kind of aspects that we all have, and how much you have, that decides if you have autism spectrum disorder or not. And our study actually suggests that's the more of the latter case. And the listener is absolutely right that we have some, but to make the diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder, we have some kind of functional impairment, and they're struggling. It's not just having a little bit of trait or tendency, but they do have to meet the criteria, which means that they have functional impairment and their struggle is significant.
We've just got half a minute before the break, but does it matter that this was done in South Korea? We'll look at that in more detail, but are children globally similar enough with all cultural and, I don't know, even genetic issues aside? Do you see these numbers as universally likely applicable?
Yes, short answer is yes, and we can continue to talk about it a little later.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the prevalence of autism in children. A new study finds not one in 100 or one in 110, but one in 38 with an autism spectrum disorder. The lead author of that study, Dr. Youngshin Kim, is with us today, published today in the American Journal of Psychiatry. You'll be able to find a link to it at our website. You'll also find there the screening a questionnaire, 27 points, 27 questions, that was given to all parents of all children 7 to 12 in a substantial town in South Korea where this study was done. It's a very interesting questionnaire. Whether you're on the spectrum or not, I think you'll find it really interesting to look down through that, think about yourself, think about people that you know. Dr. Kim, please stand by there in New Haven. I want to welcome into our conversation from Walnut Creek, California, Lisa Crowan. She's director of the Autism Research Program, senior research scientist at Kaiser Permanente, Northern California. Lisa Crowan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So 1 in 38. I've got a lot of reaction here online. Here's one, Lisa, from Bill. He says, my son is 23 years old. When he was first diagnosed at around 3 years of age, 20 years ago, rule of thumb was about 1 out of 250. 1 out of 38 is mind-boggling, Bill writes to us. How do you look at this number, Lisa, Dr. Crowan?
Well, you know, I was shocked like the rest of us, I think, reading this paper and seeing a prevalence estimate of 2.6%. I think this is really an astoundingly high number, and was unexpected for me. I've done a lot of research in autism and have been looking at prevalence in California and tracking trends over time, and we're seeing about 1% what the CDC reports, the national surveillance studies are reporting all around 1%. So to see a 2.6% estimate is quite frankly very shocking.
2.5 times as much. How do you read it then? I mean, do you buy the number? How do you read the difference?
Well, you know, that's the million-dollar question. I think the methods that Dr. Kim and colleagues used in Korea are methods that will result in higher numbers than the methods that are typically used in the United States for looking at prevalence.
And say why again, from your perspective, that might be true.
Well, when you go out and screen every child and ask everybody, those who are concerned and those who aren't concerned, about certain behaviors and certain communication, possible communication impairments or social impairments, you're going to find more than what you more children will be uncovered, so to speak, than if you just rely on what's recorded in medical records or educational records. So there are individuals in communities who may meet diagnostic criteria, but have never come to light, so to speak, in terms in the medical system or the educational system. They've never been given that label before. And so when you use those kinds of methods of screening a total population, you are going to find more individuals who meet the diagnostic criteria.
So when you raise that perspective, are you raising a doubt that these children are actually on the autism spectrum, or simply saying, no doubt about it, probably, given the way they've done the study, but we wouldn't find them in the American system?
It's really the latter. My belief is that I think that these children did, they do meet criteria. The way that the study was conducted was very rigorous, and the individuals who are evaluating the children clinically were using these gold standard instruments, as Dr. Kim described, and so they do meet the diagnostic definitions. However, I think if you use the same if you did the same kind of study in the United States, I think we would find somewhat higher rates than the 1 in 110, but I don't think it would be nearly as high as 2.5%. And that's because I think in the United States, from what I understand about what's happening in South Korea, from what the author has described, it seems like there's a lot greater awareness of autism and autism spectrum disorders in the United States. And so many more individuals will have already come to the attention of the medical system or the educational system and will have been given a diagnosis. Certainly not 100%, but I think a lot closer to 100% than what the authors found in South Korea.
There's a lot to unpack there, but I want to go first to Dr. Kim, Youngshin Kim, and the cultural setting in Korea. As I read your report here, on the one hand, the Korean education system, which is more about rote learning, perhaps more disciplined and strict than the U.S., seems to be a setting in which these children may actually be able to operate more effectively. On the other hand, you report such a serious stigma attached to autism in South Korea that people don't want to report it. Do you see, you know, how does the culture factor into the way this prevalence presents itself in Korea, Dr. Kim?
So you pointed out two very important points already, and in a very nice way. So we can think about autism spectrum disorder more a biological disorder. So even if it's a lack of social reciprocity, the presentation of autism spectrum disorder in Korea or in US or in Western other European countries or in Africa is exactly same. They have hard time to make eye contact, make facial expressions toward other people, have reciprocal conversations, etc. And those presentation of autism spectrum disorder exactly same, identical across the children with autism in across different countries. So the cultural factor doesn't affect on the presentation of the symptoms. It may affect on the case identification processes, such as stigma, because we have a strong stigma for not only for autism, but also for psychiatric disorder in general. So that can give us an underestimation of prevalence had we used the record or registry. So that's why one of the other reasons we wanted to go to the total population.
Do Korean children on the autism spectrum actually function more effectively in the Korean education system because of the style of education that's done there, Dr. Kim?
That's what we think because of the high-structured classrooms and very routinized class activities and not much time for the children to have social interactions. So as long as you do not have disruptive behavioral problems in class and you have good cognitive skills, which these kids in regular education have, then you could pass academically. But when they are left alone or left with other kids to do the social interaction and social engagement, they do struggle significantly.
I want to bring our listeners in, many acute listeners here paying attention to your new results, Dr. Kim and Lisa Krohn, please stand by. Let me go first to Fremont, Nebraska, and Kim. Hi, Kim, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that the number from Dr. Kim on my own observation seems to be pretty accurate. My son has been back and forth diagnosed as autistic, but it just seems like there are more and more around our area who are receiving that diagnosis and getting help.
I'm sure your son's diagnosis has made you very attuned. When you look across student populations, then you're thinking, oh, 1 in 38 with some touch or more sounds about right, you're saying, Kim?
Yeah. not too far off. It just, you know, you hear it coming up more and see things, and just even looking at, you know, across the broad spectrum.
Does your son have serious, I don't know the right language here, but like serious autism or just a little?
Sure. No, and it's certainly not classical autism. Mm-hmm. One doctor that looked at him said, you know, if he has anything, it would be PDD-NOS. Because, and somebody else said he didn't have it at all because he actually wants social interaction. He's not always very good at it. He has the kind of sensory oversensitivities, light, sound.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask him questions, he will kind of shut down.
So there you are with
your son.
Kind of
easily overwhelmed, I guess, is a better way to put it.
Right. He's kind of on the boundary. So you're in a way, you're really, you're grappling with maybe exactly this kind of boundary range that is included here in this study. Kim, thanks for your call. Lisa Crowan, now, I think you said you thought if the study were done in the United States, it would not come up with such a high percentage. Kim calls from Nebraska, just as a layperson, it seems about right to her. But how could it not come up with just with the same? I mean, if this is kind of standard human profile of autism, even if Americans are more open about acknowledging and addressing these symptoms, shouldn't the prevalence be the same?
Well, my this is speculation on my part, mm-hmm. so we're not going to know the answer until
right.
we do the study, and I hope we do the study in several different communities in the United States. But having said that, my gut feeling is that the numbers would not be quite as high as what is being found in South Korea because there's quite a bit more awareness of autism spectrum disorders in this country, and I would say less stigma associated with autism than what I'm reading is the case in South Korea. So that I think we've done a better job currently of identifying kids on the spectrum and, you know, giving them a diagnosis and hopefully getting them into appropriate educational settings, special education classes or whatnot, so that there are fewer children who would be in regular classrooms unidentified.
Maybe fewer waiting to be found in a study like this. Youngshin Kim,
mm-hmm.
The study hasn't been done, but if it were, do you presume we would find the same, more or less, 2.5%, 2.6% of American kids on the spectrum or not?
As I said, it's not going to be exactly 2.64%, but I assume that it's going to be projected, it's going to be 2 to 3% range. But as Lisa pointed out, that more children are identified with autism spectrum disorder in the U.S., so probably the proportion that we're going to find in the regular education mainstream schools are going to be smaller than the kids that we found in Korea. So, for example, the proportion we had for the ASD children in high-risk special education children versus regular education children was 0.75% versus 1.89%.
But that's about probably education systems and special education systems.
That's correct.
It's still the same overall population. We just shunt them into different settings.
Exactly. That's my point.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, we have about 1% or 1.2% in the U.S. for the special education population.
Mm-hmm.
Thus, we may end up with 1.5% instead of 1.89% or 1% in the regular education system. But at the end of the day, the total prevalence of ASD would be in the range of 2 to 3% if we use the same method in the U.S. too.
The screening questionnaire is up at our website. The kind of questions asked to this big population in South Korea about kids there to begin to investigate whether they might be on the spectrum, autism, lacks empathy, makes naive and embarrassing remarks, has a deviant style of gaze, wishes to be sociable but fails to make relationships with peers, and a lot more. It's really interesting. You can see it at our website, onpointradio.org. Big new study on autism and its prevalence. Let's get a call from Anne in Middlesex, Vermont. Anne, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I can give you a really good example of what this can do to an individual child. My daughter, as a preschooler, was just an absolute bundle of joy and very bright. And as soon as she hit school, she completely ran up against kids who didn't like her aggressive behavior towards them. It was joyous, they couldn't understand. And she went through her entire childhood. No friends, kids throwing rocks at her, going into a depression, almost suicidal. She's now a senior in high school, and she has been treated by a psychiatrist who said she might have Asperger's when she was about 12 or 13. And I asked, well, what could, and she was being treated for depression at the time and ADD.
Yep.
And I said, well, what would be the treatment if she were to be diagnosed with Asperger's? And the psychiatrist said, nothing other than what we're doing now with these medications. And her grades in high school were up and down all over the place, but she's so extremely bright. Her national boards and her SATs and college boards are 99th, 98th percentile,
yeah.
And yet she could not get into a college that she really desperately wanted to go to.
Oh, Anne, it's such a tough story.
It's very hard, and I am myself suffering from a grave depression for years because, on behalf of her, because she has no friends and no social life and no normal childhood.
Some things, I don't know what's treatable and what's not here, but if this were more widely understood, if the language and in reality this were more widely understood in elementary school, do you think it would have been easier for her, Anne?
Oh, I went every new teacher every year. I knew that there was something going on that was different about her. She would come home complaining about how she was being treated, and I would talk to the teachers at the beginning of the school year. I want to know what she is doing, and no one would cooperate with me. No teachers would tell me because she was out of my sight, and I could not see what was happening. It was so frustrating all through those years. And then when she was in sixth grade, she was finally designated a special needs child under federal 504 designation.
Mm-hmm.
And the teachers just, from then on still, they just thought she wasn't passing in her homework because she was lazy. They didn't understand the depression. No teachers helped at all. And
Anne, we're up against the break here, but I so appreciate your call, and you have our full empathy. I mean, this is what it's like to be up against this, and your daughter able to function in school. There's a lot more we want to look at, but Lisa Crowan, I mean, everybody talks about rising rates. In a nutshell, do you think we're seeing an epidemic, a rising prevalence, incidence of autism, or is that still unknown?
Well, we certainly are seeing a rising prevalence, and as Yongshin described, the prevalence is when you go out and count right now mm-hmm. individuals on the spectrum, how many do you find? That's, you know, the current, what's out there, not how many new cases, but what's currently out there. And study after study has shown that the prevalence has been increasing and very dramatically over the last several years, last couple decades, in fact. What's not known and what we're trying to understand better is why that might be happening. Is it really a true increase in incidence in the
mm-hmm.
rate of new
mm-hmm.
autism? Are we doing a better, or are we simply doing a better job of counting?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the prevalence of autism in children. Big new study finds not 1 in 100 or 110, but 1 in 38 with an autism spectrum disorder. The lead author of that study published today in the American Journal of Psychiatry, and you can link to it at our website. Dr. Yongshin Kim is with us from Yale's Child Study Center and joining us today from New Haven, Connecticut. With us as well from Walnut Creek, California, Lisa Crowan, director of the Autism Research Program at the Kaiser Permanente, Northern California. Let's go right to Atlanta, Georgia, and Sharon. Sharon, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for allowing me to express my opinion, my thought. I'm a retired educator, and I certainly am listening with interest because it is studies such as this
mm-hmm.
that will be most helpful for educators in our efforts to make sure that we meet the needs of children. I'm not surprised by the numbers at all. In the last 10, 15 years, as I, as a professional, started really observing children and understanding more about autism, certainly began to see larger numbers of children that I could identify as students with those needs.
Sharon, let me ask you, as your understanding maybe moved from there's something odd about this child to, you know, an understanding more grounded in understanding of autism and the autism spectrum, how does that change the way you might interact or handle a child? How is it helpful?
Yes, absolutely. I think the most common observation of a teacher, of a practitioner, is that difficulty, that challenge that students have with social reciprocity.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing that and understanding that children then need assistance in making those connections with others helps us to know certainly what we need to do, but secondly, that indeed it is a diagnosis. Is something that's not just going to go away, but it is something that we need to pay attention to.
There's a welcoming position there from somebody with a lot of years in the field and experienced in teaching all kinds of kids. Sharon in Atlanta, thank you very much for that. Let me get one more right here from Fort Dodge, Iowa, and Evelyn. Evelyn, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
I guess I have a comment and then a question. My comment is that I actually have a 7-year-old son who has been diagnosed PDD NOS, and he has not a lot of the things that you would typically see in a child that you would consider autistic.
Okay.
He does love the social interaction. He has friends. He does like the touching, the hugs, the kisses, that type of thing.
Yep.
So a lot of times for people, it's hard for them to understand that that's where he falls. But then I can actually, as I'm listening to this show, I can actually, empathize and understand your previous caller's position, because I also have a daughter who is now 14, and she very much suffers from the lack of social ability to maintain or obtain friends and things like that. So from my perspective, it's very difficult for me because I have one child who has been medically diagnosed and is getting the help that they need. And on the other hand, I have another daughter or another child who is also being, like her daughter, treated for depression and anxiety, but not getting to that root point.
And so, are you afraid, Evelyn, that they've simply missed the some autism spectrum situation with your 14-year-old? Or
I do, and I say that only because a lot of the key things that get people to become aware of autism or maybe think their child has autism is the wanting to be by themselves, or the pulling away from social interaction, or the lack of speech, those types of things.
Mm-hmm.
Where with my 14-year-old daughter, I believe she would fall mainly under the Asperger's syndrome, which would be she did verbalize at a very early age at a normal pace. So I think it was kind of overlooked. I think we have some people that look at the autism as just this rigid set of people. And they're not looking past to the other spectrums.
Yeah, no, I'm glad for your call, Evelyn. This study certainly focuses us on the whole spectrum that Dr. Kim has here. Lisa Kron, can you give us a little definition help here? PDD-NOS, you use that. Our callers are using that. Is that the autism spectrum? Does that include Asperger's? What's the range?
But PDD-NOS is one of three diagnoses that are included in the autism spectrum disorders. So PDD-NOS stands for Pervasive Developmental Disorder, not otherwise specified. It's a very long,
okay,
cumbersome name,
mm-hmm,
which we like to say PDD-NOS.
Is autism one thing? Does it have one root? Does it have all kinds of roots? Do we know?
Autism is a very complex set of disorders. It's a spectrum, as we've been talking about. It is not one disease or outcome or disorder. It has a huge range of expression, and you know, as we're talking, all the callers are bringing up, not any one individual with autism looks or acts like any other individual. They share a common set of behaviors and impairments, and especially social impairments in social interaction and impairments in communication. But there's a very wide range of expression, and that's one of the reasons why it's been so difficult to find out what's causing autism, and that's why we need very, very large studies, population-based studies, to so that we can include the wide range of expression of autism and then try to get at the root of what's going on.
Do we need to deal with the whole range of expression, or is some of it, and Dr. Kim's study is bringing all this to the fore, but is some of it just, you know, so slight an end of the range that it's just kind of awkwardness rather than something requiring medical diagnosis or treatment? Lisa?
Well, I think as she pointed out, these children in South Korea who did not, who were in regular schools and hadn't come to attention of the teachers and so on, do have functional impairments, and they may be able to do well in that school setting, in that very highly structured environment. But I think their parents report and that there are some functional impairments, and the children may not be able to make appropriate friendships or meaningful relationships. And I think she would be. I'd like to hear what she has to say about that.
Yes, please, Dr. Kim. You know, what about? Are you? Maybe you don't have any stand on this, but are you suggesting with this number that everybody who falls into your 2.6% needs medical treatment of some kind? Or just understanding at the lighter end, or what?
So the reason that we are labeling children with some kind of diagnosis is not just for the sake of labeling, but try to provide proper interventions or understanding what kind of help they need. So, yes, they need some kind of help, for sure, all of them. The intensity of the service they need to get may differ from individual to individual. Some might need a little bit of help, like peer coaching and social skill training, and some might need more extensive service, like having very specialized educational aids and behavioral modification strategies and social skill trainings and all some speech therapy and all sorts of treatment. So it's going to differ. But yes, definitely they need it, because the social reciprocity we have is it's our instincts. We're born with it. But these kids need help to learn those things. These children cannot understand when you're talking to other person and the person is yawning or looking at their watch frequently. That means that the person is not interested in your talk, and that they cannot get it. We have to teach them all those repertoire and what means the social cues and things like that. They need to learn.
I've got lots of questions here on exactly that. You say most of us are born with social reciprocity instincts. Are people on the autism spectrum not born with it? Do they lose that somehow? Here's a question from Jennifer, who says, I know autism has been associated controversially with infant child vaccinations. Lots of refutation of that recently. Nevertheless, we know that's been out there as an idea. She says, I'm curious about the vaccination schedule in South Korea. Is it similar to ours in the United States? Is it significantly different? Dr. Kim?
It's as similar, it's almost identical as that in the United States. So there's not much difference.
Here's another question from Krista. I often wonder if there's a link between rising rates of autism and ADD and food allergies and our modern food system. These days, we ingest so many processed Frankenfoods, chemically preserved, packaged, etc. What about the why of this? Do you look at that at all, Dr. Kim, in this study, or have you paid attention to why we have this rising prevalence?
Yes. So one of the things that the researchers have been trying really hard is to find the etiology of autism spectrum disorder so we can find possibly cure and proper interventions for the autism spectrum disorder. And so far, the etiology of autism spectrum disorder seems to point to genetics, and it's mostly genetic origin, 90%, more than 90%, and the rest might be environmental factors and some of the gene-environmental interactions. So in our study, even though we didn't, this is not a study to do the environmental factor assessment.
Right.
However, we are establishing this cohort to do the future studies. But this is a very, the autism spectrum disorder is an early onset disorder, and there is a very narrow range when the environmental factors can kick in to produce the disorder. So it's between like during the conception, pregnancy, delivery, and probably first or 2 years of life. And there are only so many things can happen. And the food allergies and that kind of thing might be more plausible if it's a later onset disorder. But I think that could be, that needs to be tested, but that's not on the high list of the things.
90% genetic, you're suggesting so many questions on that front when it comes to autism. Let me go to Camille in Nashville, Tennessee. Camille, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've got a son who has, he was suspected in school of having ADHD and Asperger's when he was in kindergarten. I found a group of psychiatrists that had offered a, authored a book called The Misdiagnosis and Dual Diagnosis of Profoundly Gifted Children. I went to one of those psychologists, took my son to one of those psychologists.
Yeah.
And my son is, in fact, two standard deviations from the norm on the gifted spectrum. He is profoundly gifted.
Mm-hmm.
Using interventions similar, or using interventions used for children with Asperger's, they downgraded his diagnosis to a PDD-NOS diagnosis. In the school system, the psychologist said he was not autistic at all. In addition, I changed his diet. I did the environmental factors. We follow a program called the Feingold Program that removes artificial colors, flavors, and sweeteners, and that also has dramatically changed his behavior. And so I wonder if a lot of these autism diagnoses are not misdiagnoses.
So at the end of the day, do you think your son is on the spectrum or not then, Camille? What are you being told?
No, I don't believe he's on the spectrum. The further he gets in school, he's in third grade now, the teachers don't think he's on the spectrum. They keep the diagnosis because it keeps him on a 504 plan. He's eligible for further interventions if he needs them.
Right.
But none of them think he's autistic.
Boy, wrestling right there at that border, and that's where Dr. Kim's work points as well. It's really interesting. I want to get one more call, if I may. Camille, thank you. Therese in Greenwich, Connecticut. Therese, you're on the air.
Thanks for having me, and I'm very grateful to the research that Youngchin Kim is doing. I have two sons that, as the former caller said, you know, are very bright. They're 10 and 12, and they come from a line of mathematicians, physicists, you know, all these mad scientists. There's two points I have. One is the personal aspect of it gets to the point where middle school years where they are socially awkward, but it gets to the point where the higher functioning ones and the Asperger's, PDD-NOS are really suffering because they become painfully aware that they're not, they don't fit in.
Right.
And then you see the increasing result of high anxiety and depression.
Right.
And that just worsens the scenario. So I really wish that schools would institute more of the social skills learning in a more explicit way, because these are really bright kids that learn quickly, and but they need the explicit tools.
They need the help, and we may need their genius even.
Well, that's my second point, is that on the bigger picture, you have renowned people in history like Einstein and Mark Twain and Bill Gates, they've alluded to, that these kids have incredible creativity, and that's what our society and our industry needs, is the next big idea that might spark the growth we need in a new direction for our country that then trickles down to jobs growth and economic growth and
all the rest.
So exactly. I just think it behooves us to really cultivate the strengths of these very creative, talented kids, because they do have a bright future if we channel those strengths in the right direction.
Therese, I appreciate your call. Youngchin Kim, Dr. Kim, Last word goes to you. This is a big piece of work. You really have moved the goalpost, the understanding here. What do you hope people take away from this? When they hear that 1 in 38 number, how do you hope, we've just got a minute here, how do you hope they respond?
Okay, the first thing that I want to say is that this number doesn't mean that we have all of a sudden more children with ASD. Rather, it seems that they have been there all along, mm-hmm. but they were not counted in the prevalence studies. Mm-hmm. And secondly, that this means, our study means that of the children with ASD, about two-thirds are in the community unrecognized and untreated. And these are whose lives can be improved significantly with better early identification and intervention. And we as a society have responsibilities to provide these things for our children.
Well, you're really opening our eyes with some dramatic numbers and some big important research. We're grateful for it. Dr. Yongshin Kim at the Child Study Center, Yale University, lead author of the big new article in the American Journal of Psychiatry. You can link to it at our website. Dr. Kim, thank you very much for your work and for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom.
And Lisa Crowan with Kaiser Permanente Northern California, joining us from Walnut Creek. Lisa, thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.